Bettering your business takes working with the best. With the James Hardie Alliance, you gain access to leads, training, networking, and support from the number one brand of siding in North America. Achieve new levels of success by joining the James Hardie Alliance today.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 771.PS2509, certificate number 37241. Joe Meek.
I know that you love music. You're a music lover.
I gotta say, one of my favorite things to listen to.
Yeah.
Music.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Top 10.
I've known you to listen to music. I've known you to be knowledgeable about music. How knowledgeable are you, would you say, about the production of music?
Oh, almost none.
Really?
Like I'll, almost none?
Almost not.
Does none even modify how knowledgeable are you?
None more black.
None more knowledgeable. Yeah, I feel like when people describe, like I know effects that I can hear in a song.
For instance?
Go ahead. Preverb.
Preverb. Okay. Yeah.
Or like an effect, like a effect on a guitar, you know, like a wah-wah pedal on a guitar.
Oh, okay, a wah-wah pedal, good.
Or, I guess reverb, that would be more normal than preverb.
Yeah, reverb, as we say,
preverb,
as we famously say.
It's not like the NFL where they have to say defense.
Instead of defense?
Yeah, they switch to defense.
We do say reverb.
You do say reverb.
Yeah, okay. Not reverb.
Okay. Did I say reverb?
You said reverb.
But I said preverb.
Preverb, yeah, you said.
As the old preverb goes.
As preverb and reverb.
Is preverb just reverb that's perverted?
Preverb. reverb works a lot of different ways, and you can, if you're monkeying with it, actually have reverb that precedes the introduction of the sound. It's an advanced effect.
You hear kind of the echo coming in.
Yeah, it's a swell in. Yeah.
Somebody write us a letter about? Oh, I know what this is. Yeah, this is from a recent Addenda show. Somebody wrote in. They made a little omnibus sample thing that they had that they'd put a little beat on. And they used gated snare because they know how much you love gated snare.
Oh, I do.
And I know that is some kind of effect you can put on the snare that does something weird to its waveform. I have no idea either how you do it or what it would sound like.
Well, you know, the love or hate of gated snare is kind of a music producer, in particular an 80s music producer sound that in the 90s was really unfashionable and made a sort of shorthand for an example of bad production that now that we're in the 90s and we're making cool rock again, we don't use this terrible gated snare. And I have worked with a lot of people that, and because I was making records during this era of like the gated snare, because it was famously a sound used by Phil Collins and perhaps invented by Phil Collins, but it was, it's just a snare drum that has a noise gate, you know, a gate that cuts off noise below a certain.
This is not a physical point. Gate. This is some kind of engineering thing you do to the wave of the drum sound.
That's right. It's a compressor.
It's like a filter or something.
It's a compressor that shuts down the sound after it goes below a certain volume threshold.
Does that mean it ends abruptly?
Yeah, and what gated snare is it's really a gate on the reverb. And if you think about it, Phil Collins' song In the Air Tonight, that dun 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 dun, you know, that the signature sound of the 80s snare drum
that you just did amazingly.
What happens is it doesn't have the long tail that actually hitting a drum would, which would be.
I see.
If it had that much explosive sound on it. And instead it has this really punchy, tight. And you hear it in Phil Collins' recordings, and then it became a ubiquitous sound in the 80s. And then in the 90s, it was really out of fashion. And if you used a gated snare, if you used gated reverb, you were a real dud. But I was not actually opposed to it. I was never one of the like gated snare haters because, frankly, I was too dumb.
You didn't think it got poisoned by?
No, I was too dumb to hate anything. But all of this stuff, because now, of course, it's come full circle. All of these sounds are just tools in a toolkit.
I've read enough rock criticism to have heard about the toolkit. You know, to get the vague idea that a producer might do something unusual, like put the drummer in a closet or, you know, a different part of the room or something, or, you know, totally take out the bass from some sound and I just don't hear it. I guess, like, I don't think I have a very good ear for that kind of thing. Or maybe not a good memory for it. Do you think most, would an average layperson listener just have to have that stuff pointed out to them? Or, cause I don't know if I could identify a typical drum sound of a certain artist, or here's what's weird about the bass on this record.
And partly that is because you're like a fish that has never really thought about water, right? You're soaking in the world of music production. And for the most part, every song you've ever heard has been subjected to some form of production. So your like lack of whatever articulateness or language or even perception of what it takes to get a group of musicians in a room to making, you know, the process that goes about making that music into Dark Side of the Moon or, or Old Town Road or whatever.
Those are the two things I would like to make. Yeah.
The two sounds that,
that exist
that you think about when you think about music. Everything that goes into that process, you've lived with your whole life, and until you sit and spend, and I think in a lot of cases spend hours trying to make recorded music, you don't realize how much goes into it, how alchemical it is.
But it is an artistry, like all this stuff about the studio wizards and stuff. Like in your experience, that is real. Like not just anybody can put four guys in a room and get the right sound.
In the original days of music recording, the first music recordings were recorded through a horn, through like his master's voice style cornucopia horn.
And then Lead Belly sitting over there.
Right. And it went directly to a cylinder or a wire or a wax where the needle was actually cutting the recording surface based on vibrations that were coming through a horn, you know, singing into the wrong end of a trumpet. And as music recording technology got more advanced and we started using magnetic tape, the original recordings were in mono, which is, you know, just it's one sound.
It's the not, same in your left ear and your right ear.
Right, not separated into stereo. And also was recorded onto just one track of the tape. I mean, the idea of putting two recording heads next to each other and splitting the tape in half effectively and recording one thing on one side and one thing on the other was an invention. Someone had to say, what if we made these heads smaller? And but every time you do that, if you have a piece of tape that's 1 inch across and you put two heads on it instead of one, each part of that tape now has half the information, half of the amount of surface area that was previously holding the, you know, pulling the sound, for lack of a better term.
Wait, does this mean that when we hear about, you know, in the early days of rock, for example, studios going to 4 or 8 track recording, they're still just using one piece of tape? They're just using strips on the tape?
That's right.
I just assumed they had figured out ways to use and synchronize multiple strips of magnetic tape.
There was that during a period when 4 track recorders, when you were trying to make 8 track recordings, but you only had 4 track recorders.
Oh, that's what you would do.
You'd put 2 4-track recorders next to each other or use them.
But a 4-track recorder is using a single strand of tape.
Yeah. And and the tape, you know, tape machines use different widths of tape, eighth inch, quarter inch, half inch, 1 inch, 2 inch. And 2 inch tape really was sort of the max that tape recording ever went to in terms of width. And 2-inch tape.
I've never seen 2-inch tape. Think how wide that is. It's like duct tape.
2-inch tapes are the tapes that you see in pictures of old mainframe computers.
Yeah, the big reels.
Where the big reels are going. That's 2-inch tape. It's the same tape that's used to record rock bands. And 2-inch tape became the industry standard at a certain point in the 1970s. But, you know, the Beatles, all their records until the very end were made on 4-track tape machines, and that's one piece of tape that has 4 recording heads on it, each one recording 1/4 of the surface area of that tape, and they're capable, because they're separated, and there are 4 playback heads, that each track is effectively a separate piece of tape. It's just one, it's all together on one reel.
And if you have more than 4 threads of music or whatever, you have to mix stuff down onto one track. Is that right?
Yeah. So that is part of what you're describing is what happened over the course of this period of innovation in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, where recording technology was being pioneered and used in new ways to make more complicated recordings than you could when you were limited at first to one microphone in a room.
A live recording, essentially.
And then with the advent of a mixing board, which is a set of inputs that you can put multiple microphones into, adjust their volume each individually, and then run that mixed set of microphones into a recording machine, first one track, then 2 tracks, that you could make more and more sophisticated recordings. But original rock music or any kind of recorded music, the first idea was put everybody in a room, put a microphone up, and play the song as many times through as it takes to get everybody to do it without messing up.
And it must have sounded pretty good, because we still listen to that. Like, if you're listening to Elvis, Scotty, and Bill, it's one of those, right?
Right. And early recordings, it's a whole symphony orchestra with one big microphone in the room.
Sure.
And those microphones are very well made. They're big. They have a very large diaphragm that's capable of picking up a lot of different nuance. But the art of recording at the time had a lot to do with, like, you put the louder instruments further away from the microphone and the quieter instruments forward.
Which is what you would do in a stage setup anyway, right?
Well, I mean,
often an orchestra has.
Right. An orchestra would. Yeah. Like electric music, you have a lot more, have a lot more ability to turn up, turn down.
Right.
And especially now when most live music is sent through big amplifier setups, you know, like public address systems, the onstage sound can be really quiet relative to what you're hearing in the rock show itself. You know, Neil Young famously plays through a very small little Fender Champ. It's just, there's a microphone in front of it and it's sent out through tens of thousands of watts of amplifier.
Wait, I should know this and I don't. That's what happens? You just put the PA, the venue sound is just a mic sitting in space in front of the amp?
Yes. Over...
It's not directly connected? Like, it's not electrical?
No.
Why is that better?
So the amp has a distinctive sound that comes out of the speaker, and the speaker changes the sound, right? I mean, the amplifier itself...
The artist wants the speaker to sound
that. And in a lot of cases in rock music, you know, the speaker imparts its own form of distortion and compression to the sound that the instrument's making. So if you sing into a microphone as a vocalist, that goes straight into the public address system. It doesn't go out through a speaker and get recorded through another microphone.
That would be crazy.
Although
apparently all guitar sound is.
That's a way you could create a vocal effect, but most guitar sound is. Now bass guitar is often plugged directly into the PA because a bass waveform takes longer to develop. Bass is harder to capture with a close mic on a speaker because the bass wave is much longer. And if you put a microphone against a bass speaker, you need a much bigger microphone and it's oftentimes much easier just to run the bass straight through the PA. The PA covers the big sound wave. But a guitar sound, almost every guitar you ever hear in a live music context is coming through an amplifier, through a speaker, and then a microphone in front of the speaker.
That seems a little bit nuts. Is there any sense in which that's just all cultural and there could be technological ways to give you the guitar sound you want without that step and nobody does it?
Yes. It's called modeling. So software is now at the level that it can imitate the sound of almost any great instrument.
But as soon as it's that, you're going to have people being like, it doesn't sound the same.
Well, and I've been to a lot of concerts for a while. Weezer traveled without amps. They just plugged into little digital preamps that made their guitars sound really cool. And then out through the PA. But everyone agreed it sounded terrible. ZZ Top I saw do it one time. Part of the problem is when you go to a show, you're used to hearing sound come from the stage. And you hear the sound in the PA if you're standing in the back of the room. But even then, you're hearing a loud stage sound and then the PA is somewhat augmenting it.
And if you're actually dancing down front, it's disconcerting if Weezer's guitars are making no noise.
When I saw them at the Showbox, there was like this hollow vacuum in the... coming from the stage and then all of this music coming out of the PA. It was very weird. But that was early days of attempting to do that. The thing is that the desire to make music something other than just a reproduction of what a band is capable of doing in a room is a thought technology. It's an idea that...
It would not have occurred... It doesn't follow naturally.
Right.
From the idea of music. What if we could make this sound different than the musician actually does sound?
Right. Here we have five people. They've all learned the song. They know their parts. What more is there to do than to put them down on tape?
And if you were doing it from scratch, your degree, your measure of success there would be like how faithfully you reproduced the actual performance.
And your desire as a producer would be to get those musicians very comfortable, to have them, because the same group of five players can play the same exact song 20 times, and each one of those takes has a different feel. Mm-hmm. And what you want as a producer, to a large degree, is to get the best feel you can.
What percentage of the job is psychology versus technology?
Each individual musician also has their own trip, and a great producer can pinpoint a person that's having a bad day or can figure out a way to get you to find a performance in yourself. If you think about Sympathy for the Devil by the Rolling Stones, they recorded that song 100 million billion trillion times, literally. over the course of weeks and weeks and weeks. They would get in the studio and they would play it, and they would try and add this, they would try and add that. It never came together. It didn't ever click with anybody. And over the course of all that time, one day they just played the version of it that we all know and love. Presumably you love.
I do. And they all the knew song. It at once?
Yep. Well, the basic tracks, right? The vibe, the bass and the drums and the rhythm guitar, the thing that establishes the tune. And there's a lot of debate. There are a lot of songs you hear on the radio today where it is completely unnecessary that any of the players on it ever meet.
Yeah.
They are recorded separately. They're all playing to a metronome, in headphones, potentially in their own basements or home studios. And then the producer, you know, mixes the song together using all kinds of digital manipulation. But in songs like a Rolling Stones song from the 60s or 70s, it was still, and in any Long Winter song you would have heard, or any indie rock song, or, you know, rock vibe song, absolutely your hope and desire is to get as much of that down with the musicians playing together in a room to make it happen live, so that you get that, the ineffable, the
it's funny that the ineffable is audible, you know.
The ineffable is so key.
Because you wouldn't necessarily think that it would be. You'd think that how the musician feels is important to the musician, but you could never see it in the waveform or hear it on the record, but you can absolutely hear it.
Absolutely. Absolutely can. And what makes Sympathy for the Devil such a great track is that there's an impossible amount of vibe in there that, I mean, everybody that ever worked with the Rolling Stones said that 9 out of 10 takes that they had in the studio were terrible, unlistenably bad. It's just that they sometimes clicked into a magical state, and were lucky enough that they lived in a time when they had the recording resources to take that many shots at it.
I mean, as a rationalist, I would believe that everything is quantifiable, that somebody can point to, you know, what's the exact moment where there's you know, a millisecond of delay between the bass and the drum, you know, that could point to the exact factors that make that take better. Or, you know, the volume is 10% higher here than it was on the other, you know, there are ways to do that. You know, it would take all the magic out of it, but that's what we're measuring, right? Little tiny things happened that didn't happen on the other takes.
Well, there's an entire industry within the music production world devoted to discovering and mass producing exactly what you're talking about. People that have examined the waveforms of the best microphones, the best amplifiers, but also the best sounding rooms.
Yeah.
So that, you know, they go into the great halls and they make field recordings, just what it sounds like in the room with no sound happening. And they can then interrogate those sounds and create digital, you know, algorithms that would allow you to take a song you recorded at home, send it into Royal Albert Hall as a facsimile, and then, you know, bring that sound to your Macintosh.
I guess that ruins the magic of it if that actually works.
Well, hard to say, because a lot of the music that you listen to now is a product of a lot of that kind of manipulation.
But a lot of music today does kind of have a soulless feel. Well, so,
and that's the other argument. And the argument that the day that we stopped recording onto tape and went entirely into recording onto computers was a day that a lot of magic was lost. And a lot of this has to do with the way your ear naturally receives loud information. You know, the ear and the brain impart a natural compression to loud sounds or to sound, because your ear is capable of hearing and perceiving nuance in both a boat horn and like a feather, you know, whispering against a butterfly, which happens, you know, as you know, every day.
I love listening to
feathers whispering against butterflies.
Do that again, ASMR.
Very common experience. But your ear has this incredible range, and part of how the ear does that is that it's able, in conjunction with your brain, to reduce the relative volume of super loud sounds and amplify the relative volume of super quiet sounds to make them in your world. You still can tell a loud sound from a soft one, but you're not forced to, to your brain is able then to put those into knowable sort of sound limitations where you seem to hear both on a related scale or a yes. similar enough scale.
If the proportion was actually what it is on paper, you know, one was 10,000 times the amplitude of the other or whatever, you wouldn't even be able to relate the two.
Yeah, your mind wouldn't, that's one of the amazing things about your mind and your ear. And in recording music, there is a need for a technology that effectively does the same thing, because the music that is recorded is going to come out through your headphones or your hi-fi speakers, and those technologies are not capable of reproducing the great breadth of amplitude in actual sound and life, but they need to approximate it. You know, you don't want to hear, or the suspicion would be that you wouldn't want to hear sounds that sounded chemical. You'd want the recorded sound to approximate what it would be like to hear it in life.
You're making it sound like that's not an absolute limit, though, that like there's a possibility for better amplification or playback tech that somehow could duplicate the range of actual sound.
That is also
we just don't have it.
Well, it's an arms race too. I mean, increasingly sound amplification technology, I mean, it continues to advance by leaps and bounds. And we're able now to hear recorded music with such a much better fidelity in some ways, right? But
still nothing like the breadth of life of the ear.
Hard to imagine, but we can fool the ear by using limiting and compressing technologies that basically bring the volume of quiet sounds up and bring the volume of loud sounds down.
And it must be good, because when you listen to recorded music, you don't think this is nothing like music. You actually think this is exactly like music.
And there are lots of different ways that compression happens, right? Just the technology of putting music onto tape has inherent limitations that act as a form of compression. Mm-hmm. If you hit tape with sound that is too loud, the tape itself it puts a shelf on how reliably it can reproduce the amplitude change. And tape compression is a thing that we talk about a lot in recorded music, that the sound of the tape actually grabbing and compressing that music is its own form of
what is that sound? Little iron particles shifting around on the surface of the tape?
Yeah, little iron particles putting a limitation on how much of that sound they can absorb. And that itself is a warm and inviting kind of because it's not an abrupt change. It's a smooth roll off of loud noise. And what you hear, what abrupt sound is, and you hear this a lot in digital, is where compressors or limiters cut off sound past a certain point. And what that ends up sounding like is distortion. It ends up sounding like an unlikable distortion, a brittle sound where past a certain loudness, thou shalt not pass. Whereas with tape, that's a kind of a lovely rolling off of volume. And we often, and I think this is true even now, but in my own recording life, we would record things like bass and drums, things that had very high transient sounds, very, like sharp attack. We would record those onto tape, even though all we were going to do was then immediately import those recordings into digital, because the tape itself compressed the sound in a pleasing way, kind of better than any outboard machine could do.
Reading about studio experimentation like this, like I'm constantly struck by how it's almost entirely trial and error.
Yeah.
Right? Like nobody's, I mean, there are general principles, but those had to be discovered. And, you know, for each new song, it's almost like a new experiment.
Right.
Nobody sat down with a piece of paper and figured out, okay, I've got it. Here's where we put the mic. Like it really is like, here's a great new way to record acoustic guitar. And I had to try 500 things that sounded like crap before I found a good one.
Well, and once you discover those things, they're not set in concrete. Like the way that an engineer records acoustic guitar is very individual to every engineer and almost always completely individual to an individual recording. So once somebody put a microphone in front of an acoustic guitar and got a great sound, they didn't, in most cases, nail that microphone to the carpet and nail that chair to the floor and say, that's where you sit. And because the next guitar player plays the guitar in a different way. And that microphone setup wouldn't work the same way for them.
But can you hear a producer or an engineer's style?
Oh, they sure hope so.
I mean, you would like to think so, right? Because they want to feel like they're part of the art. But I don't know if, again, not having a good enough ear. I mean, I guess I can hear Phil Spector's bag of tricks, but I don't know if I could tell if it was him or an imitator.
Well, and what Phil Spector did was, I mean, we're about to start talking about Joe Meek, who was a man that really pioneered a lot of this idea. And Phil Spector is another very famous producer from this dawn of using the studio as an instrument in and of itself. But what Spector did, he realized that that just a band of five people in the studio plucking away didn't actually manage to communicate the intensity that one feels in seeing a live show. And Phil Spector's innovation was, well, what if I fill that room with people and I have three bass players all playing the same part, four guitar players playing the same part?
I don't think I knew that's what the wall of sound was. It's not multi-tracked over itself. It's multiple instrumentalists.
It's 30 people in a room playing the song, playing the music of five people.
And the idea is it somehow suggests one guy playing live.
So you've got a grand piano, you've got a parlor piano, you've got a Rhodes piano, and they're all playing the same part. And what it was overdubbing or multi-tracking, but it was just happening in the room. And he would rehearse these bands and he would put his microphones in the room until he got that sound, that amazing, huge sound. But it's really just musicians in a room.
A lot of pressure on the musicians to play in perfect synchrony.
Yeah,
right?
You don't want to screw up, right? But you know, that we're talking about a time when there were an awful lot of good musicians in the world.
Not like today.
Well, like a lot of crafts, right? There used to be a lot of people that were very good at working with plaster. A lot of stonemasons or carvers who found a career and a craft and an art in doing one thing really well. And that has been, that's true of musicians too. And I think that now there are fewer great musicians. There are a lot more basement musicians now, people like me, who I don't think anybody would say I was a particularly gifted instrumentalist in any way, but I can play 20 different instruments and because recording technology...
It's the technology that's kind of leveled the playing field?
No, what the technology has done is made it so that you can play the studio just as well as you can play the guitar or better. And playing the studio doesn't just mean that you go in and correct mistakes that were played on poorly on a guitar. It means that you're making a record that is more than just a recording of a performance. It becomes, as the word suggests, a production. You're trying to get sounds rather than just songs. And that has been the evolution of recorded music from the late 50s on. And a lot of that, a lot of the, both the technology and the idea, or the ideas involved, were sort of generated from the imagination of Joe Meek.
What were his innovations?
Well, Joe Meek was a guy born in the UK in the late 20s who had an interest in electronics. He's from Gloucestershire and worked kind of, he was a science fiction fan and went to work. He joined the Air Force and worked on radar.
He's a nerd.
He is a nerd and a, you know, and a soldering iron nerd and a like looking at VU meters nerd, loved it and pursued it, like just from an independent fascination. There's some sort of speculation that he had the first television in Gloucestershire because he built it. And you know, like who knows what he was watching on it.
Yeah. Did he pay his license fee?
He loved music and he loved monkeying with machines.
What would music have been for him? Is he like jazz?
Yeah, jazz and the kind of, you know, the dance hall music of the 40s and 50s. He was not a musician himself. He could not play an instrument or write music, but he had a natural gift for it and a gift for sound. So that when he started building things and tinkering with devices, he had a really good sense of what was, I mean, to put it in ASMR terms, like what was the pleasing amount of manipulation.
It's interesting that he can do it with no musical background. You know, that there are good producers who are also great musicians and instrumentalists, and you'd expect that. Yes, you know, this is the guy who knows how this sound gets produced and what's important about the, but it turns out you don't need that to hear it.
Well, Joe Meek also was a songwriter and composed lots of songs, including hit songs, and he did it by surrounding himself with musicians and actually humming in their ear. Like it goes like this.
Oh, he can never read music?
No. And they would put it down. You know, they'd like, they go, you mean like this? And he'd say, yeah, but with the, and he had guys that wanted to work with him and he wrote hit songs this way.
That's an even greater kind of genius, right? Mm-hmm. If you can't fall back on, it's actually in B, it's a blues progression. Like if you're actually just kind of hearing it,
yeah,
you're like a savant.
There are lots of people in my experience, maybe not lots, but there are plenty of people in the music business that come at it that way, who either didn't learn a musical instrument or were afraid to learn a musical instrument just because it seems like such an insurmountable task to go from wanting to play guitar to actually playing guitar.
Especially when, like him, you're surrounded by people who are very good at it.
And he got into it by working as a tech person, right? He got into it from the electronic side and started working with other people making music, working in studios, gradually got frustrated and went out on his own. And so he was born in 29. By the time he was 30, he had opened his own record label, Triumph Records, and had started kind of putting out attempting to make recordings and release them. But what made Joe Meek different was that he regarded these technologies as a means to an end. He wasn't afraid to manipulate sound if it made a more pleasing sound. And this is an era when you think about the guys that recorded that were the recording engineers of the day. They thought of themselves as scientists. You know, they wore ties and lab coats, and you saw this in the early days of the Beatles when the Beatles would try to get things to distort in order to have a cool sound, the you know, the EMI recorded guys would
say,
like,
do that.
No, this sounds terrible. This is garbage. The idea being like, we have all this machinery. We've built all these machines to get.
We've got a checklist.
Fidelity.
Yeah.
Right. And Joe Meek was not, didn't think that way, even in the early days. And if you think about 1960, it's a transition era. There is rock and roll. And it's the kind of, you know, it's a sort of hillbilly skiffle music,
rockabilly,
and by 1960 it had sort of it has kind of fallen out of favor. There was a lot of cool jazz happening, there was soul music happening, but it was not the rock music that we came to know. And Joe Meek was a difficult character, abrasive, opinionated. He ended up building a studio in his apartment. He had a sort of three-story house called, and it was on Holloway Road in Islington. And it's kind of a legendary place, 304 Holloway Road. And he built a studio in his house and was building all of his own gear. This was stuff that, you know, EMI could afford to build because they had a whole laboratory.
But he was just sending away for parts.
And he was just sitting in his house welding stuff together, you know, soldering stuff together and building all kinds of things and pioneering all manner of technique that ended up being the techniques of the world of recording. He was one of the first people to think about reverb as an effect, right? Reverb is just the sound of music echoing off the walls.
It keeps going after the initial attack is over.
Yeah, it's just the sound of you being farther away from the instrument than, you know, your ear isn't against it. And so you hear not only the sound of the instrument, but the sound of the environment as the sound kind of, and this is a subtle effect. Anybody listening to this recording is going to hear the difference in the sound between my voice this far away from the microphone and this far away from the microphone. And the closeness of my voice when my lips are right against it.
Should we let them vote?
It creates, you know, a very intimate sound, and it has a lot more bass to it. As I pull the microphone away, and this is not a microphone designed to be used at a distance, but you can hear a lot more room. You hear the squeak of my chair more profoundly.
People love the squeak of your chair. People have started to count it on Twitter.
Yeah, well, it's a very good squeak. Any chair I sit in begins to squeak. It's just like you can put me in a $10,000 suit and it will wrinkle instantly.
Well, I remember you bought these chairs because the old ones were squeaking.
Yeah.
And now mine is not squeaking, but yours is.
No. I mean, I outweigh you by 100 pounds.
But is that really what you're doing? Well, you're just putting wear and tear on the chair?
I think so. I think I just am harder on furniture.
I thought it was just something emotionally you were doing.
No, I break chairs. But to use reverb as an effect, like to put reverb on vocals and instruments separately, to add it in later, to really saturate reverb so that it sounds like you were recording in a sewer, or even to make reverb sounds that don't sound like something in real life.
Is he doing this in acoustic ways, the placement and directionality of mics, or is he figuring out a way to like kind of loop the sound back and I guess simulate reverb?
So different sounds for different pounds. Different,
as we say in Islington. That's kind of a North London saying.
You can at EMI, for instance, what they did was they had a basement room there at Abbey Road that they would play music through a speaker down in the basement and put a microphone at the far end of the hall and re-record the Beatles playing through this speaker.
Is it happening after? This is something you would record later once you've got the...
You can do it either way. You can record it in real time and put it on the track, or you can use it as an effect.
It's so crazy the kind of Rube Goldberg stuff you have to do to just get like a sound that to us now sounds pleasing and intuitive.
But there are other ways. You can, there's what's called spring reverb, which is that you have two plates that have kind of long springs that are look like the kind of springs you would see in a couch. And the plates are electrically connected, and the music goes into one plate, reverberates through the springs, and is recorded by the other plate, and that creates a very pleasing sound.
And you'd think it wouldn't. It's metal boinging.
Anytime you hear an electric guitar that has a surfy kind of reverby sound, yeah. It's that sound has gone through a set of springs. And any guitar amp that has reverb on it, it's a spring reverb. And if you hit a guitar amp, I could turn this one on right now and hit it. It will actually go bow, wow, 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 because the springs are vibrating.
It's funny how basic it must be in the brain that we all kind of agree, this is an agreeable sound, but that one is not, based on slight differences in the materials that are doing this. For some reason, we all kind of evolved with this shared sense of, this is a good guitar sound, that one's not.
Right. Well, and it depends on what you like, right? If you're into thrash metal, you're going to like a guitar sound that's a way different thing. Hang on, let me see if I can get this amp to do it.
Oh, we're doing live. How'd you do that?
I hit it with my hand.
Oh. And that's more or less how spring reverb works?
Yeah. Now that's an AC-15 that I hit with my fist, and the springs inside went wah, 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 wah. There's also plate reverb, which is as it sounds, a giant metal plate that is similarly, like sound is electrically sent into one side of it and recorded on the other. And the sound of it going through this plate is a different kind of reverb and an expensive one.
I like that it's so inscrutable, you know, like you can't justify what you're doing. Even after you hear it, all you can say is, to me, that one sounds better than this one. And the guys agree, you know, that's
right.
It's almost like, I mean, there's really no other art form like that. Can you imagine a poet just kind of, I mean, putting down random words and then being like, nope, 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 nope. Oh, hey.
There's a good one, a good combo.
I think it's Stendhal who said that music is the purest art because it's not trying to be anything else. A painting is trying to look like a landscape. A story is trying to recount a narrative. But a symphony is just itself, you know, like a guitar sound is just itself. And so that's the only standard is how pleasant was that sound as a sound, right?
But recorded music then became a thing that was no longer trying to sound like a bunch of musicians in a room.
It's even more its own thing then. It's even more Stendhalian, you know? We're not trying to capture anything so much as we are is just to make you smile.
Well, what music does is somehow, inexplicably, ineffably, create an emotional reaction.
Yeah.
That someone hitting one note on a guitar can make you feel lonely or elated.
And it's a very complex emotional reaction. You might not be able to put a single word to it. Like, you'll just be like, that's the feeling I get when I hear that song.
That's right. And so what some of the things that Joe Meek pioneered are the idea of close miking. This whole thing we were talking about, where you put a microphone up against an amp to get the sound of the speaker. Prior to that, you put an amp in a room and you put a microphone all the way across the room to get the sound of the amp in the room.
That would be someone playing music in a room, yeah.
And Joe Meek, and partly he discovered these things because he was making these recordings in his house, and people in the shop down below were actually banging
is that right?
They're banging a broom on the ceiling when he was too loud.
His neighbors.
And he would reply to that by turning the speakers, putting the speakers face down on the floor and turning the music up.
I guess one thing about it being in your house is you have time and space to tinker.
Right.
It's not a 9-to-5.
But so he was one of the first people to record bass just plugged directly into the board without going through a speaker. DI, we call it. He invented quite a few different like compressors. He invented the idea of separating instruments from one another and not just having them all in the same room playing at the same time, but, you know, separate tracking, separation of sounds. He was one of the first people to say, we're not just going to make this recording where you start at the beginning and record the song all the way to the end, but we're going to record the chorus and then we're going to stop and we're going to record another part separately, or we're going to take two different recordings and splice them together.
Is this partly psychological for the artists? Like, if we start in the chorus, you get a different...
A lot of it is him just searching for the best sound. And a lot of these techniques were just his imagination and whatever was expedient. He ended up having a number one hit. Joe Meek wrote a song.
Like, not produced by him? Like, he's the artist of record?
Produced by him, and he wrote the song, but because he's not a musician, he put a band of guys together called the Tornadoes.
Oh, I know this song.
And the song's called Telstar.
That's a big hit on both sides of the Atlantic.
And Telstar was a song about a Telstar communication satellite.
If you didn't know he was a nerd, this guy wrote a number one song about a satellite. And how he wanted to kiss it. No, it's an instrumental, right?
Yeah, an instrumental song. And in fact, it was the first number one song by a British group in America.
That's the trivia question. Yeah, because it's almost a year before the Beatles, right?
Right. Well, a couple of years before the Beatles had a number one hit in America. This was in 1962, right? So I guess the first Beatles hit in the U.S. would have been 64, right? Love Me Do?
I think 63. 63
in the U.K., but was it 60? Was it a hit in the U.S. in 63?
Yes, that's right. Love Me Do came out at the very end of 63, but it did not chart until January.
I know things.
Is that the sound of you knowing something?
That's,
yeah. So I have a question. Do you always do that music, and then do you do the finger guns?
I use finger guns, to, as you know, to accentuate a lot of different...
This is why you've never been on Jeopardy, because they'd only get like four clues in. Every time you get one right. All right, John, select again. Hold on a second.
Pow! But Joe Meek was also a tragic figure. He's not... he's a tragic and problematic figure. He was a very difficult guy to work with, and a lot of his... a lot of what could have been great successes for him ended up... He was great at seizing defeat from the jaws of victory. He very famously was consulted by Brian Epstein about whether or not Brian should sign the Beatles, and Joe Meek was like, they're garbage, don't sign those guys. He passed on David Bowie's early recordings, thought he had no talent. He heard Rod Stewart singing with one of his first groups and agreed to sign the group, but only if they kicked Rod Stewart out of the band.
What does this mean? He has bad taste?
He has, he's very opinionated, and despite all of his innovations, he wasn't really very rock and roll. You know, he came from a kind of a different school, and he wanted to make space age music. He actually made a record that didn't come out in his own lifetime, and it was he put a band together called Rod Freeman and the Blue Men.
Is there actually a Rod Freeman?
I don't think so. But he made this record, I Hear a New World, about like outer space.
So is he using kind of his studio wizardry to create what we think of as these kind of 50s sci-fi sounds?
Yeah, I mean, not theremins, but he's making...
But they have those kind of otherworldly radio effects.
Yeah, interesting sound collages. Sadly, he's also bipolar and schizophrenic and consumed with paranoia, increasing paranoia, and strangely, like he got a call, like a cold call from Phil Spector one time. Phil just trying to like make friends with him. Phil Spector, a famously like stable man, and Joe Meek like hung up on him and was like, "Phil Spector's trying to steal my brainwaves through the phone." Also,
I guess you live in this private world where you're the only person who can do your genius stuff that you do. And that probably, if you've got a tendency for that kind of stuff, it probably isolates you further, because you're not wrong. Like, other people don't understand your concerns and your the things you care about.
Right. And he's also on drugs right. During this era.
I would assume so.
This is like the barbiturate mixed with speed era, and he's taking both.
Can't you just take neither and get the same effect? That's what I would do.
Well, no, it doesn't work that way. They don't cancel each other out that. And he was gay, and a gay man during an era when the music industry was a place that you could you could be gay, not like out in the larger world, but it wasn't it wasn't an impediment to being successful in music. Brian Epstein was gay. Robert Stigwood, who mm-hmm. went on to produce the Bee Gees and Saturday Night Fever.
You were discreet, and your mates might have a laugh, but you wouldn't get drummed out of the industry.
Right, and there was a lot of, you know, I mean, music is also always a place that's a respite or a safe harbor for people of across every aspect of queer spectrum. He and Robert Stigwood actually collaborated on some early productions, and it was, you know, he was kind of mobbed up with the music world of England in the early 60s in a way that would suggest that he made one of the first recordings of Tom Jones.
Really?
And it was, he tried to get Tom Jones a record deal, and kind of at that point, like, nobody wanted to deal with Joe Meek. And it wasn't for a year or two, it wasn't for a couple of years that Tom Jones finally recorded That's So Unusual, at which point all these recordings, like...
I mean, I get that that's a little prescient, but if the same guy is really boosting Tom Jones, but he's skeptical about David Bowie...
He worked with Bowie, Gene Vincent, Denny Lane, Jimmy Page, Ritchie Blackmore, all these guys before... some of their earliest recordings were with Joe Meek, and Joe just kind of didn't know what... He didn't have the business side of it figured out. And he became, as his mental health declined, he became more and more consumed with conspiracy theories. Sadly, the story with Telstar was that he was sued by a French composer named Jean Ledru, who in 1960 had made a recording called La Marche to Austerlitz.
It's Napoleon themed.
It's from his play Austerlitz, or his short film Austerlitz.
This is what French popular music was at the time.
And he sued, saying that Telstar was a ripoff.
Huh.
And so throughout Joe Meek's life, he never received any of the royalties from Telstar, which sold millions of copies, because this lawsuit was underway. And it wasn't until a scant few months after his death, Joe Meek's death, that the lawsuit was resolved, and it was determined that Austerlitz, La Marche de Austerlitz, was not available in the UK. There was no way he could have heard
it. So it was just some coincidental relationship of melody or something.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And it was not, it actually, there was no basis to the suit.
The French.
Contributing to Joe Meek's paranoia was the fact that in 1963 he was nabbed in a sting in a public toilet in the UK soliciting.
Homosexuality was still illegal.
Still illegal. He was fined £15 for having basically had a wide stance in a public toilet. But this now put Joe Meek on a list in the UK where, you know, persecuting homosexuals was, in the UK then, as in the United States, kind of a thing that the police could do selectively, just as they persecuted people that were smoking marijuana. They could do it if it served their purposes. They weren't interested in filling up the jails, but it was a thing they could
just
hold over your
something
head
to do. So it didn't hurt him professionally, but he was just harassed.
It didn't hurt him professionally because within the music world, it wasn't that big of a deal, but it subjected him to blackmail because he didn't want his mother to find out. He didn't want it to be out in the world. He didn't want to be in the newspaper.
And if you're prone to conspiracy theory thinking anyway, like it's only going to intensify that when they really are out to get you.
That's right. And he believed that the Cray twins, the famous UK gangsters,
criminals,
were, and it's possible that they were actually blackmailing him because of this prosecution. And it put him on edge, and in some ways accelerated his decline. He continued to be like in demand as a producer, despite having burned a lot of bridges, he gradually lost touch with the zeitgeist. He was convinced that his landlady was stealing his ideas through the chimney between their apartments.
She was listening.
She was listening. He thought when he went out in the street, he always wore big sunglasses and a disguise because he thought that he was being followed
by the Cray brothers.
By the Cray brothers, among others. And then, sadly, the tipping point for him seems to be the murder of a man by the name of Bernard Michael Oliver, which was a celebrated murder in early 1967.
Who is this guy?
Bernard Michael Oliver was just a working class lad who was, I think, gay and was suspected of trafficking in male attention during a time when all of this was against the law. And he was discovered cut up into 8 pieces, packed into 2 suitcases and thrown into a hedge.
Whoa.
And there was, and it was a national scandal.
This is in London somewhere.
Yeah. It was a crime that happened somewhere between London and Southern England. Suffolk, mm-hmm. I think, was where he was discovered. But he was in the scene. He was in the gay scene. They couldn't tell his identity at first. And actually, kind of scandalously, the British cops published a picture of his severed head, asking people to identify him.
Wow.
And his family saw it in the newspaper and said, "That's our boy."
Well, you would have, wow, late 60s, you would have thought there'd be more of an outcry about that kind of imagery.
But pretty bad. And I mean, I've never seen the picture, but I imagine that they didn't show it. I mean, they probably draped it in such a way that it wasn't explicitly a severed head. But as Scotland Yard started to investigate the murder, they made it clear in the press that as part of their investigation, and this is a murder that remains unsolved.
Oh, yeah.
That what they were going to do was interview every documented gay man in London as a way of, you know, narrowing the search. Because they could tell that he had been assaulted, that Oliver had been sexually assaulted.
I see.
And so with this threat of interviewing every gay man in the country, because of his conviction for this bathroom crime, Meek suddenly felt like he was about to be outed by Scotland Yard, that his name would appear in the newspaper, that he would be scandalized, you know, that there would be a tremendous scandal. But also this was just the final straw in a long and gradual,
decline into
schizophrenic break. And so just a less than a month later, Joe Meek, with a shotgun that he'd sort of confiscated from one of his bandmates after an earlier episode, took the shotgun, killed his landlady
for her chimney related,
for her chimney snooping, and then killed himself. Mm. And this is in February of 1967. And left behind a trove of unreleased recordings. He'd been experimenting throughout his entire life. He'd just the recordings that had made it out into the world. He'd had over 245 singles.
Would he assemble musicians for these, or was he self-taught enough that he could play his own?
No, he couldn't play a thing. Okay. The Tornadoes were his house band, and they were making music with him throughout the whole period. But he also had he did recordings for numerous other artists. He had 45 top 50 singles in the course of his life. A lot of them songs that that you probably wouldn't recognize. You know, the singles chart is a kind of weird and fickle place.
Sure.
And novelty singles and songs that didn't make it into the...
Because the big artists are probably not recording at this guy's house in Islington or wherever, right?
Right. But he's managing to get tunes on the charts. He's coming up with interesting sounds
And they do have a Joe Meek sound, huh?
They do.
Like, it's not just that he's very skillful at, like, some musicians, some producers maybe are just very skillful at bringing out the sound of the artist, but you wouldn't think this sounds like Quincy Jones from artist to artist. Maybe he's a bad example.
Well, and what I think was happening was that although his songs weren't making it to the very top of the charts, a lot of musicians were listening to his recordings and producers listening to his recordings, back engineering how they were made. Hmm. And then kind of duplicating those sounds, duplicating the effects, and also imagining the studio as its own kind of instrument to play. Going in and not trying to make your record sound like a band in a room, but trying to make sounds come in from left and right, sounds where you're not clear. I mean, one of the great things about the Beatles is that you're not clear what some of those sounds are.
What am I hearing? I'm not even good at separating in my head. Like, I'm hearing the music, and right. I think a better ear and maybe somebody with more musicianship would be able to say, ah, that's, you know, there's actually, sometimes I won't even, like, I'll listen to something 20 times and then I'll be like, wait, there's brass in this, you know?
And part of what you're experiencing is a wonderful thing. I remember very distinctly when I lost the ability to hear music without picking out the bass and the drums and the guitar and the keyboards and hearing them individually. And I kind of long for a time that I could just listen to a song and hear it as music, because although it's a wonderful like Pantone of colors that I'm able to hear in a song, I can't just hear the magical kind of mystery of a tour, for instance. But you know, like it doesn't just come into me as a flood of emotion.
I haven't done a lot of screenplay work, but I think I know a lot of the structures well enough that I have the same problem now where I'll watch an episode of TV and I'll be like, well, you can see the problem they're trying to solve. Like, all you can see is
right.
structure. You can see the problem that was trying to be solved and the attempts and kind of gauging your head what you might have done. And it's just terrible for suspension of disbelief. And it's got to be even worse for music, which is theoretically should be a much more kind of abstract personal experience.
It's amazing because you can hear incredible performances, right? You can hear, when you listen to Marvin Gaye's What's Going On and hear the bass and recognize what is happening in that bass line, you can marvel at it and celebrate it in a way that you never would be able to if you were just listening to it as a magical work. But it does become technical. You do start to see multiple people rather than just the magic ghost of song.
I mean, you mentioned thrash metal, and I had the experience of like just reading a lot about what's the Slayer record, Rain and Blood,
yeah.
and just realizing how like technically near impossible the stuff is you're hearing. And suddenly something that like aesthetically I could take or leave, I was just fascinated by, because like in some kind of Guinness Book of World Records way, you're kind of listening to some pinnacle of human right. achievement.
The fastest thrash.
And I never would have, I could not have appreciated it without somebody explaining to me what I was hearing.
Yeah.
But that's not what most people would get out of that record. You know, for most people, the more they know about how it was done, it's taking away just the pure, fury and fervor of it, I guess.
Yeah. Whatever, why ever it is we listen to music to give an outlet to emotions, to stimulate them, to give them voice, to give language to feelings. The legacy, the final legacy of Joe Meek, his incredible trove of tapes that had recordings of young Bowie, young Jimmy Page.
Oh, he kept everything.
They were all in this footlocker that was purchased by a man named Cliff Cooper for £300. Immediately.
Did he know what it was?
Or? Yeah. Oh yeah. Immediately after, Joe Meek's suicide. And it took a couple of decades just to archive all those recordings. They're called the tea chest tapes because they were found in a tea chest. And they're gradually, you know, the tea chest tapes gradually become available over time. In the early 90s, an engineer by the name of Ted Fletcher brought out a line of boxes, audio processing boxes, compressors and limiters, based on Joe Meek's designs, which he called the Joe Meek series. And
he was not just kind of reverse engineering the sound. He actually built the things the same way Meek had.
They were, you know, they were tributes, yeah. I think. But the Joe Meek stuff became really popular stuff that you see in recording studios today. People using Joe Meek brand compressors. There's actually a microphone called the Telstar that gets used quite a bit in recordings. And, you know, Joe Meek has within the, obviously, legendary status, but he also now is, you know, he's invoked sometimes in making recordings. Like, you know, you want to, not quite as an oblique strategy, but, you know, to take a Joe Meek approach.
What would Joe Meek sound like?
Yeah, what would Joe if I were screaming Lord Sutch and you were Joe Meek and we met coming through the rye.
I mean, that's a great compliment to somebody who came at it from the science side, who was a nerd and a technician, to have such an influence on the like the emotional effect of the music that people speak of it as a kind of an abstract quality, the result of your work. I mean, that doesn't happen in too many technical fields. Like
no, it doesn't. And you know, he's also in that pantheon of like British gay innovative tech nerds who were persecuted in their time.
Sure, he's like Alan Turing with if he got to hang out with Bowie.
Right. And then validated by history.
And that concludes Joe Meek. Entry 771.PS2509, certificate number 37241 in the omnibus. Futurelings, as always, we hope that our social media presences, to which we devoted way too much of our time, are still preserved on whatever remains of our global information network, if you have access to that. I'm at Ken Jennings on Twitter. Please follow John at John Roderick, who needs it more, on Twitter, Instagram, all of the above. Jointly, you can look for at Omnibus Project to keep up with our endeavors. You can send us email if that's available to you at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can send us physical mail. We get a lot of beautiful mail. Have you seen?
We do.
Look at this, John, from Dave here in Seattle sent us an envelope that he apparently made himself with our pictures on it.
Look at us.
Now, I should be clear, it also has an address. It didn't arrive at us just with our pictures.
but that means that many, many postal employees between there and here had to look at you and me smiling out.
Wearing hazmat suits. Yeah. And there's no explanation, as far as I can see. There doesn't appear to be a letter in here. Dave just sent us this without comment.
It is a patch of Royal Sabena, and Sabena was the national airline of Belgium.
Yeah, I think we mentioned it on a show, didn't we?
Did we? But I didn't realize it was, and this is like a patch that looks like something you would wear on your military uniform. Is this from a pilot's uniform?
Is this stolen valor? If we pretend to now be...
I don't think so. It doesn't exist anymore.
Sabina's gone, right?
Yeah. Sabina's gone.
Well, that was nice.
Sabina's gone with the wind.
Are you writing a new hit right now?
No, that's that's an old hit.
And it's called Sabina's Gone? We also got two postcards. Our friend Mark, that does watercolor paintings, has sent us.
Oh, his paintings are so wonderful.
Has sent us a look at what's the name of the transcontinental system with the arrows?
Oh,
whatever we call that show.
This is one of our quizzes. One of the intra.
It's called
Omnibus
the
quiz.
The transcontinental. I can't even find it. The giant yellow arrows that go across America. He has, and look at the beautiful shadow work. You can tell it's late in the day. That's lovely. If you have access to our Patreon, you can see we post pictures of Mark's work.
That's really good.
There, and we also got a postcard from our friend Sparky from Lake Havasu City, who has a remarkable story. What do you know? What the biggest site in Lake Havasu City is, John?
Lake Havasu City, the biggest site is London Bridge.
That is correct. And he talks about how his grandfather was born in London, and after living quite a life, including Geneva and Buenos Aires, he retired to Lake Havasu City, and he spent the last 10 years of his life still walking everywhere, crossing the very bridge stone he had traversed as a child in London in the 20s and 30s.
You know, London Bridge has been on my list of omnibus topics from very, very early on. And I think in honor of that... In honor of Sparky, I'll make London Bridge my episode next week.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give you the postcard so you can prep from that.
Nice.
As I mentioned, being able to take a look at some of the weird stuff people send us is one of many perks available to supporters of the Omnibus Project Patreon. You can contribute to that at patreon.com/omnibusproject. You can converse with fellow listeners there or at the Futurelings Facebook page. There's also a Discord, whatever that is.
Yeah.
There's a subreddit. John has an OnlyFans. Do you do a cameo? Like if people pay you $100, will you say happy birthday to their dad
Somebody
or whatever?
Somebody wrote me the other day saying I should start an OnlyFans. And I was like, isn't that for cam girls and like sexy talk?
Yes, it is.
And they said, no. You can do OnlyFans. Anybody can do an OnlyFans. And so then I went and looked at it and I was like, I don't know what I would do here to make this exciting for people. Like, I'm still wrestling with the idea, should I do a performance? Like, even if I just turned on my cam and sat there and read aloud from my own poetry, is that right to do?
I have the guys at Cameo after me. It's a thing where you go on, people sign up for this platform and you put a price on what would be normal, friendly social interactions. I will say hello to you for $20. I will wish you happy birthday for $150. I will sing you a song for... So you got people out there. Like Jeremy Piven wants you to pay $13,000 just to have him send you a video from his phone.
I don't want a video from Jeremy Piven's phone.
I don't want anything from Jeremy Piven's phone. You'll probably get chlamydia.
Does he really want $13,000 for that?
Yeah, it was outrageously overpriced. I mean, I don't want him to sue me, so maybe I should get the number right.
Jeremy Piven... Trying to think of what I would want from Jeremy Piven if I had access to everything he owns.
The news report was $15,000 for a 10-minute Zoom call with him.
Oh.
I mean, that's good work if you can get it. That would be $90,000 an hour, right?
And he doesn't even play guitar. I mean, if he played guitar, I could see.
Yeah, if you play guitar, no price would be too. Can you imagine? Like, I would pay any amount of money just to have some guy noodle on his guitar.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Let me see, what do you think this is worth?
Take my money, John. That's fascinating. It's like you have a ukulele, but you don't have a ukulele.
It's an unplugged electric guitar.
I wish I could do stuff over this, but I think I finished the... Didn't I finish the outro? I think
I did. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come.
I just learned you can't talk and play at the same time.
I can. Let's see. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Don't miss the biggest Maytag sale of the year at Lowe's. You'll find the Maytag appliances you need when you need them at a great price. Plus, when you buy two select laundry appliances, you'll get up to a $100 bonus via instant rebate. Shop Maytag at Lowe's. We help. You save. Offer valid through 531. See store for pricing and offer details. Advertise savings on all major Maytag appliances through Maytag.com and participating retailers. Prices may vary. Additional terms and conditions apply.